3-8-3-8-3-8, the United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Robert N. Davis presiding. All of this before the court draw near, we shall be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. Please be
good morning. I am Chief Judge Davis. To my right is Judge Sholin, and to my left is Judge Bartley. We are here today on a matter of Frost against Shulkin, docket number 15-3102. And at this time, I'd like for counsel to, for both parties, to note your appearance for the record, please. Morning.
Your Honor, Will Hornbeck, appearing for the Secretary. With me at counsel's table is Joe Moriarty, Deputy Chief.
Great. Welcome. Good morning. Are both parties ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Each party will have 30 minutes to present your respective arguments. I will also compliment both parties for what I consider to be very fine briefs in, on both sides. So, and I know neither of you wrote them. But you can pass that along. They're very good. Counsel for the appellate, you wish to reserve any time for your rebuttal?
10 minutes.
Okay. Don't make that happen, please. All right, Mr. Carpenter, you may proceed.
May it please the Court. The Board in this case made two reversible errors on reasons or bases grounds. On the issue of both direct and secondary service connection for the residuals of a gunshot wound, and secondly, the failure to obtain a necessary medical opinion dealing with the issue of nexus. The Board, in its decision at page 7, made a conclusion that it was unable to reasonably associate the veteran's current residuals of a gunshot wound to the neck with his service-connected post-traumatic stress disorder. This conclusion was not supported by any explanation, any reason, any basis other than the fact that the Board could not determine. That, Your Honors, is not the legal test. The legal test is whether or not the evidence does or doesn't support it. There was no discussion in this Board decision about the evidence and how that evidence did or did not relate to Mr. Frost's service-connected disability from post-traumatic stress disorder.
Counsel, I'm with you on both issues. And one is whether the secondary disability diagnosis, the residuals of a gunshot wound, can precede the diagnosis and service connection for the primary disability, the PTSD. That's how I look at the issues. And second, whether the VA has a duty to provide a medical examination with respect to the secondary disability. Let me just ask, in the context of the facts here, where we have a gunshot wound that occurred 20 years before the PTSD diagnosis, the primary service connection disability, how can we reasonably connect PTSD symptoms to an altercation that occurred at a store between a father and a son and the appellant? With no diagnosis at that point.
If I could back up or give a preliminary response before I give my response to your question, I think it's important to understand that the issue which you just articulated is the issue that was raised by the VA in its briefing. This was not an issue that was addressed by the Board. And I think the very idea that the VA recognized that this was a problem is an implicit concession of the averment of error in this case, at least as it relates to the service connection on both a direct and secondary basis. Now, to answer your question in relationship to the government's position in their brief, that you can't get there because there wasn't an establishment of service connection for post-traumatic stress disorder at the time, I believe that that goes to a fundamental misunderstanding of how a condition, a post-service disability, is service-connected. A post-service disability is service-connected when, A, it exists after service, and there was an event, an injury, or a disease which was incurred or aggravated in service. I don't believe there can be any dispute on this record that there was clearly an incident, the train truck collision that took place, that was the incident in service that took place that produced several post-service disabilities. The question is one of nexus and how one defines nexus. And I believe that the board's, in its analysis, was using terms like etiologically related and objective evidence, which have no relationship to the correct legal standard for nexus.
Excuse me, if I could interject. Are you asserting that the gunshot wound is not secondarily service-connected to the PTSD, but that instead it's primarily service-connected to the truck incident in service?
I am not making that assertion. I am suggesting that in order to comply with the board's reasons and bases requirement, that they were required to make that analysis.
So rather than whether there was something that happened in service, isn't the real inquiry whether he already has a service-connected condition?
No, Your Honor. I do not believe so, because that only relates to the analysis for secondary purposes.
Right.
The analysis for direct service connection, which the board on its own initiated.
So you are arguing for direct service connection to the truck-related incident?
I am not arguing for that, although I think that that is a legitimate basis for consideration and one under this court's case law that the board was required to analyze. The defect in this board decision is the failure to conduct any analysis of direct service connection other than to make a summary conclusion that they could find no evidence. In order to make that reasons and bases analysis, I think you have to start from the correct construct, if you will, as to what under 1110 constitutes the legal basis for direct service connection. And those are the existence of a current post-service disability, an event, incident, an injury or disease incurred or aggravated during service, and a nexus. And it seems to me that the fundamental defect in the board's analysis was their mistaken reliance that nexus required a higher level of evidence in the record to support either an etiological relationship or an objective evidence standard for that nexus. And that is simply too high a legal standard. The correct standard is merely that there is, at least as likely or not, a reasonable relationship between the post-service disability and what took place during service, or on a secondary basis, is there a reasonable relationship to the post-service service-connected disability?
If we do discuss the secondary service connection angle, is that a factual linkage to be made between the gunshot wound and the PTSD, or the fight and the PTSD, or is it a medical one?
I think it's probably a mixed question that requires a factual understanding of what took place, which I presume in this case would come primarily from Mr. Frost, and a clinical assessment by a mental health professional to determine whether or not there is or is not a reasonable association between what took place in that store and the existing service-connected disability for purposes of a secondary analysis.
So, counsel, you're asking the court to basically send this back for a medical examination that would, in essence, provide input regarding whether or not it was more likely than not that the altercation in the store that occurred 20 years before the PTSD diagnosis was connected to PTSD.
I think that's too narrow, Your Honor. I think that this court needs to remand with instructions for the VA to obtain a medical opinion which addresses both direct and secondary service connection. The direct analysis would be whether it's at least as likely as not that there is a reasonable association between his post-service gunshot wound and the residuals therefrom and the incident that happened in service.
The incident being the truck accident.
That's correct. Which, in my personal assessment, is a resulting psychological injury. Clearly, there was no, at least as related to the gunshot wound, no injury to the neck or gunshot involvement at the time of the incident in service. But the question here is whether or not the psychological injury that took place, which he is now indisputably service-connected for and has been service-connected for 16 years, is relatable to the incident that happened in service. That's on a direct basis. On a secondary basis, the court needs to direct the board to direct the VA to obtain a necessary legal opinion as to whether or not it's at least as likely as not that the existing service-connected disability of post-traumatic stress disorder is at least as likely as not related to the incident which took place at the time of the gunshot wound.
And what role does barbiturates play in this process?
I think that's a medical judgment, Your Honor, and I'm not really sure that it has any role, but I suppose a medical person could say that there was some effect here. But I think it's important to remember that the award of service connection in this case is for not only post-traumatic stress disorder, but post-traumatic stress disorder with psychotic features. Clearly, psychotic features involve the ability of the individual to correctly perceive reality. Now, none of us were there, and I don't believe there's a very clear record of what happened in this incident, other than the fact that Mr. Frost got shot and there was injury as a result of that shooting to his neck and other residuals. The question then as to how to parse out the role of any psychotic features that he may have been experiencing at the time versus the effect of barbiturates, I think that would be an enormous challenge for a medical expert. But that doesn't mean that inquiry would not be appropriate. But again, how is the examiner to ascertain the level of barbiturate consumption at the time of this particular incident? That would seem to me to be an enormous challenge, and this court's made it clear that examiners can only evaluate based upon things that are, if you will, verifiable in the record.
Yeah. But the record indicates that Mr. Frost was on barbiturates at the time of the incident at the store, as far as I read the report.
Well, there's clearly some reference or indication of that, Your Honor. But it seems to me that the problem with that is not knowing either what barbiturates or the amount of barbiturates, of when they were consumed, and then how that barbiturate consumption might or might not interact with at least suggestion in the record that the veteran was suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder at the time of this incident.
Does it make sense, Mr. Carpenter, from a policy standpoint that this court would allow or support by remand a connection that occurred 20 years subsequent to an event to carry over as a part of a subsequently diagnosed PTSD disability?
Well, that's why I made the qualification to your first question. I'm not sure that's an issue that's before this court. Mm-hmm. I don't think you need to go there. I know that the VA has invited you to go there, but it seems to me that to go there attributes analysis by the board that's not in their decision or a conclusion in their decision. It seems to me that the error here is in the analysis of the definition of nexus and the legal standards relative to that. And those are things that I think this court can reach, because the board clearly used terms like etiological relationship and objective evidence. And as a result, those are available for this court to examine. But for this court to examine the legal proposition, now, in a second board decision, which may be as likely as not, that would come back after an examination and would make a conclusion as a matter of law that you cannot be service-connected, as the VA has suggested in its brief, when there isn't an existing service connection, then I believe the issue would be ripe for this court. I'm not sure it's right for this court at this time.
Let me press you on the two claims that you say that were at issue here, that especially the direct. I'm not sure I understand your direct service connection claim, because it sounds like just a different way of talking about a secondary service connection claim. So explain to me why what you were calling a direct service connection claim is not a secondary service connection claim.
Well, Your Honor, I'm willing to accept that there may be little difference or distinction between the two. And I'm not sure, as a general matter, that that's not correct. However, having said that, the error here was that the board undertook that analysis. And I think the board was correct under this court's case law to undertake that analysis to examine the possible entitlement on a direct basis, and they did so. But having done so, they did it without an adequate statement of reasons or basis. They simply didn't explain why. I'm suggesting...
So that's why you're going this way right
yes.
now.
Well, okay. I feel obligated to because of how the board made its decision. As I read the record, I understood that the only assertion by Mr. Frost was on a secondary basis. I didn't see an assertion by Mr. Frost of direct service connection. The board, on its own initiative, and I think subject to the this court's case law in terms of needing to examine all potential theories, examined that theory. They just simply didn't do it in accordance with law.
Okay, got it. Let's move on then to secondary service connection. Let's kind of pretend, because I'm really elaborating on the Secretary's brief here, but let's pretend that what the Secretary argued, and I think he basically did argue this, although not in so many words. Let's pretend that he was arguing that we should interpret the term service-connected in 3.310A as referring to whether of the primary condition was diagnosed and or service-connected at the time of the incurrence of the secondary condition. He was arguing that's how we should interpret service connection there.
And that's
it requires that the primary condition have been service-connected, in existence, and diagnosed at the time that the secondary service connection the secondary condition evolved. Now, what's your response to that? Is there a plain language reading here about that interpretation of service connection? And if indeed 3.310A is ambiguous, why shouldn't we just defer to the Secretary's position?
Well, as a qualifier, I don't believe that that was decided by the Board, and therefore I don't believe that it's within the purview of this Court to address that issue. Having said that, and responding to your hypothetical based upon the position taken by the government, I think the government's position is wrong. I think that the plain language of 3.310A only requires that there be a proximate relationship or that the current, or the service-connected disability be relatable to the secondary or additional disability. There is nothing in the plain language of 3.310A to suggest that or that supports the government's reading of that. And therefore, I don't believe there is any ambiguity because there's no suggestion. If there was ambiguity, I would suggest that the government's position is unreasonable and should be rejected by this Court, because the position taken by the government that there is some predicate necessary for an existing diagnosis reads language into the regulation that simply doesn't exist. The word diagnosis doesn't appear in the plain language. The word at the time does not appear. As a consequence, the interpretation offered by the VA in their brief is simply unreasonable and should be rejected by this Court.
Well, is it, so you would say it's basically, would be clearly wrong to defer to their interpretation. Their interpretation basically is clearly wrong.
Before you answer that, counsel, could you have 5 minutes of time? Go ahead.
Yes. As I understand the sequence for regulatory construction analysis, we start with the plain language of the regulation. And if the regulation is plain and unambiguous, and in this context does not address the issues raised by the VA, then that seems to me to be the end of the matter, and that's the position that I think would be the appropriate interpretation to make of this regulation.
Well, if you did admit that it didn't say anything about chronology, or the temporal, relationship between the primary condition and the secondary condition. And so I assume they could argue that it was ambiguous in that respect.
And I'm simply saying that as a starting point, I do not believe it's ambiguous. If this Court were to find or agree with the Secretary that it's ambiguous, then the interpretation that's being offered by the VA of this ambiguity should be rejected, because it is an unreasonable interpretation, and it essentially creates a limitation on the award of secondary service connection that simply does not appear. That there is nothing to suggest in the plain language of the regulation that the regulation should be interpreted as being conditional upon anything other than a relationship between the service-connected disability and the secondary condition. That's all that's required. There's no temporal relationship or pre-existing that you have to have it established. I mean, the logical extension of the government's position is that you would, in fact, have to already be service-connected for the condition, and that, at the time in which the injury happened. And that just simply is not the case.
But the language does say, except as provided, forgetting about the tobacco exception here, mm-hmm. a disability which is proximately due to or the result of a service-connected disease or injury shall be service-connected. That's
correct.
The sentence that we're arguing about.
That's correct. And if you will, it focuses on the condition, and it doesn't implore or impose any temporal qualifications on when that disease might or might not have existed. In other words, the statutory and regulatory scheme under 1110 is to compensate for disabilities which result post-service. And it seems to me that the VA is offering an interpretation that asks this court to resolve the question of the chicken and the egg, and which came first. And that's not a path that veterans should be required to go down in order to receive compensation under either 1110 or 3.310A.
Mr. Carpenter, in the vast majority of cases, wouldn't a temporal requirement make sense?
Well, I think a temporal requirement is consistent with an award. I'm simply saying that there is no temporal requirement and that this case is clearly an anomaly for the normal circumstance, if you will, in which, for the vast majority of cases that the Secretary has asked for a determination on secondary service connection, it's when something has evolved after the award of service connection has been made. The real question here is, what is there in the language that precludes this particular fact set if there is competent evidence that relates, collates the secondary, or the gunshot wound in this case, to Mr. Frost's service-connected post-traumatic stress disorder? And it seems to me that that's all that this regulation does. And I think it's also important to remember that this is a regulation that the Secretary wrote that doesn't have a statutory predicate. That there isn't a statutory provision for secondary service connection. And therefore, I believe it should be read as a liberalizing 511A regulation by the Secretary to afford benefits under the circumstances described in the regulation.
Your time has expired.
I have a question.
All right. 5 more minutes.
Are you familiar with the Jones v. West 12 Vet App case?
About where there's too many Joneses, you're going to have to help me out.
It's the veteran who was in a motorcycle accident that claimed that it was thrill-seeking behavior related to PTSD.
Yes.
It seemed, or you tell me, do you think the court set up a catch-22 situation for the veteran? Because it said that to determine whether his actions being thrill-seeking related to PTSD was a medical question. But then they said that the doctor wasn't an eyewitness, so he couldn't really opine on it. So if we follow that reasoning, what is your client going to get if we send it back for a medical examination? Or is that theory precluded by Jones?
You've asked me two questions.
Pick whichever you want and start.
Yeah. All right. Let me start with the Jones question first, because I think it's the easier answer. Yes, I believe that the court set up an impossible catch-22 in Jones. And it is not different, quite frankly, than the position I believe that the VA has taken in its brief, because it is a chicken or the egg in which you have no one who was there at the beginning, therefore other than the veteran. Now, the correct analysis is, I think, the analysis made by this court in Chota, which dealt not with service connection, but with retrospective evaluations relative to the degree of disability. And this court recognized that the duty to assist had to extend, particularly when you were looking backwards, to develop evidence. And in this case, as I believe I said to Chief Judge Davis in response to one of his questions, the only real available witness at this juncture is Mr. Frost.
Has the board made a credibility finding about his late statements?
Not that I saw, Your Honor, or not that I recall being there. I shouldn't say not that I saw. I just do not recall there being one. My recollection is that there's not. And I would think, quite candidly, it would be premature to make a credibility determination until such time as there was a nexus opinion obtained. because I would think, in response to your earlier question, that this is a mixed question of fact and law, and that the, or excuse me, mixed question of fact and medical judgment, and therefore the medical opinion should be where the development of evidence starts before there is a predetermination that the veteran is not credible.
And just one quick last question. If we did think it was appropriate for this case to pursue under a secondary service connection, and you were able to establish the factual and medical predicates that were necessary, what would the effective date be for his claim? The date of the gunshot wound claim?
Yes, which I believe was 2005, if I'm remembering the record correctly.
But not the PTSD.
But not the PTSD.
Thank you.
No, because I don't believe at that time it was reasonably raised by the record. And that, to me, would be the difference. If it had been reasonably raised by the record in 01, then I think that might be an arguably different story.
Well, since we have a minute left, just briefly, the board didn't really engage in a McClendon analysis, but you did in your brief, or Mr. Cameron did in his brief. And so go over that a little bit and also explain whether we can engage in that analysis, given that the board didn't go there.
Well, I think that's really why this is a reasons and bases error as opposed to a McClendon error. Even though there was a McClendon error, they simply didn't go there. And the reason that there is a McClendon error is that the evidence of record clearly indicated a relationship. And it was a relationship that was asserted by the veteran by the very nature of his claim. And there was medical evidence from the neurologist who saw him at the time about his mental state. And then when the VA got the examination, I believe it was Dr. Campbell in 2002, he also expressed the view that this condition had related back for more than 20 years. I hope that I responded adequately. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Counsel?
May it please the Court. Appellant was the victim of an attempted murder in 1982. This Court should affirm the Board's determination that Appellant's PTSD, for which service connection was established in 2001, was not the proximate cause of his being shot in 1982. Now, to establish secondary service connection, a veteran must show that the primary disability was the proximate cause of the secondary disability. But when you look at the facts of what happened on that day in 1982, it's clear that the sole responsibility for appellant being shot lies with the store owner. Now, the facts come from a number of different sources. They come from, as opposing counsel suggested, there wasn't enough. These sources were the police report at the time, the appellant's application to the RO in 1983 for a non-service-connected pension, and the RO's eventual determination that a non-service-connected pension was warranted based on the evidence because appellant had not engaged in any wanton or other misconduct justifying his being shot. Appellant went into the store because he was getting keys made. The store owner had made the keys, and appellant decided that he wanted the keys made in a different color. So he told the store owner he wanted them made in a different color, and the store owner said, I can make those keys, but you have to pay me for the keys that I've already made. And if you don't, by the way, I'm going to call the police. So appellant paid the owner the money. And as the appellant said, he was on his lunch break. He did not want to argue. He just wanted to get out of the store. He turned to leave the counter, at which point the store owner's son grabbed him by the shirt, and the store owner hit him over the head with a blackjack. Now, appellant stumbled back. He said he was dizzy, but he saw that the blackjack had fallen to the floor. So he reached for the blackjack and apparently hit the store owner in the arm with the blackjack because he was already in this fight with the store owner and his son. And it was at this point that the store owner shot him in the neck. Now, when the police arrived, they realized that besides the store owner, his son, and Mr. Frost, there were three additional witnesses to the scene. They eventually, based on what the witnesses stated, arrested Mr. Peoples, the defendant, for attempted murder, and brought the case before the grand jury. And the grand jury indicted based on the statements of two of the witnesses and the store owner, his son, and Mr. Frost. And then the RO ratified that determination in 1985 with regard to the non-service-connected pension. So I just wanted to get that in there because there is enough evidence on the record as to the question of secondary service connection.
But didn't the secretary also assert in his brief that it seemed to be a casual statement, but a statement of law that because of the GSW predating the PTSD service connection and or diagnosis that it could not secondarily service connect the results of the GSW?
Yes, I think our response, what we put in our brief was based on our reading of appellant's brief, essentially not just wanting service connection prior, but also wanting an effective date. We assumed that appellant wanted a service connection as of 1982 and an effective date as of 1982. And it was our position that first, obviously, to get an effective date, you had to service connect the claim first. But more importantly, you couldn't have gotten an earlier effective date. You couldn't have gotten a 1982 effective date, essentially, based on a primary claim that hasn't been appealed and for which the effective date is 2001.
Could you get service connected and have the date of claim of the new secondary condition? Has the secretary changed his position then?
I don't know that. I mean, under Galicio, I don't think the secretary would have been able to argue so that a claim, a secondary condition, could not be established prior to a primary condition. So under a situation like Galicio, you picture the average secondary service connection case. So a veteran has leg numbness and filed a claim for leg numbness in 1985. And then in 1990, the veteran filed a claim for diabetes, and then eventually wanted to go back and secondarily service connect his leg numbness as of 1985, even though diabetes was not established until 1990. Under Galicio, that would be perfectly acceptable as long as there was an open, unresolved claim for the secondary condition prior to the establishment of the primary disability.
So when the secretary said that with a quote to 3.310, that it's a legal nullity. Let me see if I can find the actual sentence. You are no longer arguing, if the secretary ever did, that this claim would be barred as a question of law. You're only asserting that the effective date could not predate the PTSD claim.
Yes, based on our understanding that appellant had requested an effective date of 1982 for a claim based on a primary claim that was not established until 2001.
I wish that would have been made more clear sooner.
I wish that too, Your Honor. I apologize for the inartful turn of phrase. If I could turn briefly.
Throws out a whole bunch of questions. Yeah, that means a lot of my questions. But I would note then, if we're getting down to the facts and whether this requires a reasons or basis remand on the facts, that you started off with a summary of facts that, although I'm not as familiar with the facts as you, I think were slightly one-sided in that I believe that there was a record indicating that the veteran became upset whenever the keys weren't made to his specifications or whatever, and he hit the owner's arm with a stick. And I'm just mentioning that to make clear that it seemed like there are some facts that don't align with your view of the facts, and so wouldn't that require, and some facts that weren't discussed by the board, and so wouldn't that require a reasons or basis remand nevertheless?
Your Honor, I believe you're referring to Dr. Hackman's discharge summary on 3991. I don't read that in tension. So what I read Dr. Hackman as saying is that he did hit the store owner with the blackjack. I don't know what the stick was. I don't know of a stick that could fracture a store owner's forearm. I have to assume that that was the blackjack. But the story of the appellant and the story that the RO accepted was that the appellant did retaliate once he was being assaulted by the store owner and his son with the very tool that the store owner had used to assault him, at which point the store owner shot him in the neck. And it was the determination of the police and the grand jury and eventually the RO that the appellant was not the ultimate. He was not. It's almost like a self-defense claim, Your Honor, which almost gets into the McClendon issue of what self-defense, what role a self-defense analysis would have in a medical examination room. But I don't think that hitting the store owner in retaliation was left out of the record. It was just that Dr. Hackman had picked up the story, the narrative, later on. Dr. Hackman didn't go to the beginning of the narrative where the appellant asked for the keys to be made and then turned to leave the store and is hit with the black.
I can't imagine a customer interaction where somebody says, I would like my keys in a different color, I will pay you for them, and I'll come back later and get them, that somebody would turn around and hit you. So I'm thinking there's more to the story than that, and it may or may not be that the veteran was violent, but he may have been verbally unhappy with the situation.
Your Honor, it's, well, two things. One, I would not presume a perfectly composed or sane store owner who's willing to listen to curtness from customers. So the police had told the veteran that this is not the first time the store owner had done this, and that when the store owner was arrested, if it was not even the second time the store owner had done this, and finally charged with attempted murder, this is the first charge, but not the first incident. But again, you can assume perhaps that there was some curtness, although
some
it doesn't.
Verbal exchange.
Exactly,
perhaps.
Exactly. But when words.
And how do you know that that level of aggression or dissatisfaction of the veteran, the way it was expressed, was not potentially the product of PTSD, even if he didn't actually engage in violence?
Well, for one, Your Honor, there were no manifestations of, as opposing counsel noted, the train incident happened in service. It's undisputed. And it's undisputed that that was the cause of his underlying PTSD. But there's no evidence in the record of any PTSD manifestations until after the incident in 1982 itself. So the psychiatric records from the 80s all describe the veteran as being despondent, as being psychologically disturbed in response to having been shot. His symptoms that later the 2002 Dr. Campbell referred to as long-standing symptoms of PTSD, like despondence, like moroseness, these were in response to him being shot. So if his being shot was not caused by his PTSD, then his being despondent at having been shot was not caused by his PTSD.
So when the VA ultimately service-connected him for PTSD, it didn't consider any of these medical reports or symptoms as being related to his PTSD?
No, and Dr. Campbell, well, except to the extent that Dr. Campbell did. Dr. Campbell considered the records from the 80s about his despondence after having been shot as his dating back his PTSD to the early 80s, in this case 1983. And so that was what was in the record as longstanding evidence. And of course, in this case, there was a question of the veteran wanting an earlier effective date for his PTSD. It was a question before the board resolved it, and appellant did not appeal it and did not put it in his briefs before this court. So the question of when his PTSD should be service-connected, when the effective date should be as a matter of law, is not before this court. But the question of just factually, was there any evidence prior to 1982 of his PTSD manifesting in a way that would cause this?
But why do we need to rely on evidence manifesting prior to 1982? I mean, this is not a Q context. We're not limited as to the scope of the evidence here. So why can't we consider everything? And why shouldn't we find that the board should have done a more thorough analysis of especially the medical evidence as to his having mental problems fairly soon after service?
Well, I will turn to the board's analysis, and it's on page 6 and page 8 of the relevant analyses, which appellant stated there was no reasons and bases, and these are the reasons and bases.
Are you on RBA at 6?
Yeah, I'm on RBA at 6, yes. It's page 6 of the decision.
RBA at 8, okay.
Yeah. Various records dating from the time of the aforementioned incident show no evidence that a psychiatric disorder played any part in the veteran's behavior at the time of his injuries. Again, this is not suggested by or confirmed by any of the contemporaneous records surrounding the incident. Moreover, the veteran was first shown to be suffering from PTSD no earlier than June 2002. And again, there is no indication that he displayed any psychological symptoms at the time of the incident resulting in the gunshot wound injury. Now, I don't think it would be worthwhile, given that we have the records from 1983, we have the records that Dr. Campbell relied on, that the 2001 RO relied on, and that the RO and board have relied on ever since to determine secondary.
I don't understand this sentence that you just read. The veteran was first shown to be suffering from PTSD no earlier than June 20. I mean, where did that statement come from? Whenever he was diagnosed with PTSD, they weren't asked for an opinion as to when he first manifested symptoms or when he was first suffering from it. So really, this is the board's supposition based on the date of the veteran's diagnosis, is it not?
It is, but I should say that Dr. Campbell did trace appellant symptoms back. So Dr. Campbell was trying, in 2002, did provide a more holistic, he not only went back to the service records describing the onset of appellant's, or the cause of appellant's PTSD, the train incident, but he also looked at the service records in, he said, he made reference to a misconduct violation that appellant had in service, and this was, I thought, important. So appellant was written up and given a summary court-martial for insubordination after his train incident. And that's the only incident in service that showed any sort of curtness. But the symptoms of despondence that Dr. Campbell in 2002 traced back to 1983 were inextricably intertwined with the gunshot wound. And I think that what the RO and the board have done since appellant filed a claim for secondary service connection has been to look at the records from the 80s and from the 70s and say whether there was any evidence of PTSD. There would be nothing for an examiner to determine. There's no other records out there, essentially. There's no other opportunity for an examiner to determine as a matter of medicine.
So you're parsing the same 2002 exam that was the basis for the award of PTSD that then said he's had the same symptoms have persisted for 20 years.
Yes.
To say that the same symptoms for 20 years relate only to the gunshot wound and don't relate to the PTSD that he's service-connected for?
Well, I'm trying not to parse it, Your Honor, so much as look at the records themselves, because if Dr. Campbell and I are both looking at the same records, then it's clear what he's referring to. And he's referring to records from 1983, which I have. The records from 1983 describing appellant in the hospital after his gunshot wound. These are, and there's another record from 1989 saying that he had anxiety and was referred to psychiatry for psychiatric help. Again, there's not a clear reference in that case, but that's what Dr. Campbell was referring to, and that's what I was attempting to refer to. If I could turn to the McClendon issue. So there's two points. The one is that on the third issue that was discussed previously, there is no evidence to indicate, and I know that indicate is a low bar under McClendon, but there was no evidence to indicate that appellant's PTSD caused him to be shot in 1982. And more importantly, as was suggested by a couple of questions previously, it's not clear what determination a medical examiner could make to determine that the PTSD, if it manifested in 1982, caused him to be shot. That sort of question, and that goes to the fourth element of McClendon, that there's insufficient medical evidence for a medical examination, or to make a determination without a medical examination.
Could a doctor say that irritability or outbursts or anger are symptoms of PTSD? Could the doctor say that based on the veteran's medical history, both lay and his own, and the records, that the veteran was suffering from PTSD as far back as that time?
Absolutely, Your Honor, but it's still because secondary service connection requires proximate cause. And as found by the police, the grand jury, and the RO, the store owner's actions broke the chain of proximate cause, broke the chain of causation, as an independent action shooting appellant when appellant had not committed any willful or wanton misconduct. The question of how curt or rude or generally otherwise behaving in a manner consistent with PTSD appellant was on that particular day, no amount of evidence in that regard can overturn the fact that the store owner broke the chain of proximate cause by shooting appellant. Well, by first assaulting appellant with a blackjack, and then when appellant retaliated, shooting him in the neck.
I was involved in a case a number of years ago, and the name escapes me now, that had to do with a veteran with hearing disability. And he was in a boating accident where I think a tow hook.
Oh, that was Roper.
Broke. And he was injured because he could not hear the warnings of his boating mate. One would argue under that same thing that the proximate cause was that the boat hurt him and the chain hurt him, not his lack of hearing. So we may have some issue with your thinking on proximate cause versus the court's thinking on proximate cause.
Your Honor, that may be the case, but it's still this court's determination to make. The legal question of whether a particular injury was proximately caused by a primary disability is a legal question. It's not a mixed question of medicine and fact. It's not a mixed question of medicine and law. It is a question of law or a question of law and fact relating to and based on the contemporaneous evidence that we have of what happened. So this court is perfectly, of course, the Secretary would welcome a determination of whether there was proximate cause in this case. That was the central argument in the Secretary's brief. No matter which way this court determines the proximate cause inquiry goes, it's still this court's inquiry to make.
Now, I believe that appellant also made an argument in his brief, a Colvin-type argument, and trying to find it here, that the board had made its own medical determinations, and I think I might have pointed this out earlier. So give me your response to that. It does seem, I mean, I pointed out that sentence beginning with moreover on RBA 8 that talks about when the veteran was first shown to be suffering from PTSD, but also in other spots, and I believe the Secretary's brief, counsel for the veteran's brief refers to this. There were some other statements here that appeared to, where the board is kind of extrapolating and giving its own medical / legal opinion. And the medical part seems to be real tied up with the legal part.
Your Honor, I obviously don't believe there was a violation of Colvin. And the reason I believe that is, again, this was a factual question of causation. And so to the extent that the board determined that there were no records in this case showing any manifestations of PTSD in 1982. That's a restatement of the examiner in 2002 and the examiner in 2013. But it's the absence of records is not a medical determination so much as just noting the absence of records.
The absence of records could be due to lack of proper development. I mean, you know, they had no Roper type opinion here to rely on or to consult to make these determinations, so they made them themselves.
Your Honor, I'm afraid there was no Roper type opinion because there was no Roper type assertion. So the veteran's theory of the case is that his PTSD had manifested in some way in the store and caused the store owner to shoot him. It's not clear what exactly the argument is. It's not clear to the Secretary exactly in what way appellant's PTSD in any way justified his being shot, particularly when he had already been receiving non-service-connected pension for over 20 years, precisely because the RO found that he did not commit any wanton or willful misconduct that brought the injury on himself, that brought being shot on himself. So there is no
okay. But are you trying to use his receipt of pension benefits to argue against his compensation argument?
No, Your Honor. Under Pacheco, they're completely separate analyses. It's only to show that when he applied to the RO in 1983, he gave the contemporaneous evidence that we still have, the police report, the grand jury's findings, the witness statements, and the RO accepted those findings because, as they still are today, they're the most credible evidence of what happened in 1982. And it was mentioned previously, it was their credibility finding. There was a credibility finding, and it was on page 7 of the board's opinion, where the board said, the board acknowledges the veteran's arguments regarding the origin of the disability at issue. However, the board rejects these arguments to the extent that they seek to etiologically relate the veteran's current residuals of a gunshot wound to his period of active military service or PTSD. And so...
Is that credibility, or is that more that they weighed it?
Sorry, the next sentence.
Oh, yeah. Okay, yes.
The veteran's statements in history, when weighed against the objective evidence of record, are neither credible nor of particular probative value. The veteran's statements today are not credible because the statements at the time in 1982, which were confirmed by the police, the witnesses, the grand jury, and the RO, all present such a cohesive and unimpeachable case that the store owner was the cause of appellant being shot in the neck, and appellant in no way brought that on himself. And so... That credibility finding is that is confirming what the RO found in 1985. So that's why I keep going back to that.
Okay. did the board decision talk about intercurrent cause?
Did it speak about what,
Your Honor? Did the board talk about intercurrent cause, breaking the chain of causation, and those kinds of issues?
No.
And also, isn't there a reg on that, which I cannot quite
3.310A.
remember?
No.
Oh, okay.
I'm using Allen versus Brown analyses for Allen's analysis of 3.310A is that it's the question of proximate cause is a straightforward proximate cause in its legal sense, as Judge Scholina described in the Roper case. And so when this court does a proximate cause analysis, it makes that sort of determination.
Now, isn't there a reg that mentions intercurrent cause? Or is that that's definitely not in 3.310A.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh. Okay.
I'm not sure.
Okay, that's all right. My only point being, it's...
Maybe 1151.
You're a persuasive arguer, but the board didn't even mention intercurrent cause, nor did it refer to... I'm trying to remember. Did it refer to... You know, grand jury testimony or any of those items.
I'm going off on page 6, Your Honor. Just this is not suggested or confirmed by any of the contemporaneous records surrounding the incident. And because the contemporaneous records all agreed on these points and the appellant had produced no contemporary records to the contrary, these are the contemporary records. This is what they say. This is where I'm getting my facts from.
Counsel, on page 7 of the appellant's brief, Dr. Campbell's diagnosis is referenced, and basically it says that Mr. Frost's diagnostic symptom picture is consistent with PTSD, appears to have some psychotic features. These symptoms have persisted for 20 years. Based on that, would there have been a reason to seek a medical opinion to determine whether or not there were symptoms that the appellant was exhibiting that might have contributed to the incident at the store?
Symptoms as of post-service pre-incident?
Right.
Because we have the record, I don't think there's a need for additional determination or asking the veteran, what were your symptoms in 1980 or 1981, because appellant's statements have been essentially, I have had various symptoms since at least 1983, that's what's documented by the record, but the truck incident is what changed me. But what the records show as of 1982, 1983, was his statements were, the gunshot wound changed me. I don't know if I will ever be able, I'm the bullet is slowly moving towards my spine and paralyzing me gradually. I don't know if I'll ever recover from this. I don't know if I'll ever feel happy about life again. That's what the records are from the early 80s, so there's not a particular need to go back and determine the causation, whether which came first, essentially, because we do have that in the record.
Okay. As I look at the board's determination, and you've referenced a couple of these passages that I actually intended to reference, and I'm glad you did. On page RBA 9, I guess, with the paragraph beginning, the board acknowledges the veterans' arguments regarding the origin. You quoted from that section. And then it did strike me that there were some credibility determinations made here by the board. And the conclusion that the board is unable to reasonably associate the veteran's current residuals of a gunshot wound to the neck with his period of active military service, or for that matter, service-connected post-traumatic stress disorder. Then over on RBA page 8, second to last paragraph, while it's true that during the course of VA outpatient treatment in October, the veteran was described as preoccupied with his disability and displaying a lot of psychological problems. Is the disability reference there the result of the gunshot wound?
Yes, Your Honor. And okay. I have the records from 1983. They're on page 3331 and 3991. And this is Dr. Hackman, who treated him in the hospital in 1983. And what he is describing is, yes, as a result of the gunshot wound, I am despondent, I am morose, I am displaying a lot of psychological problems.
Yes. Okay. That was not clear to me. And then over on the same page, RBA 8, in the, let's say, the second full paragraph from the top, in the present case, service treatment records, including a service separation examination in 1980, are negative for evidence of a gunshot wound to the neck or any residuals of such injury. In point of fact, the earliest clinical indication of the presence of any such injury is revealed by private medical records dated November 1982, slightly more than 2 years following the veteran's discharge from service, at which time it was noted that during the course of an altercation at a local store, the veteran sustained a gunshot wound to the neck. It's not your position, as I understand it, that there is a temporal requirement to the regulation such that a primary service connection needs to be in place before a secondary service connection.
Correct.
Correct. In this case, is the existence of a 20-year gap significant in your analysis?
Certainly, Your Honor. Not just the 20-year gap, and my time has expired. Can I?
Please continue. Add 5 minutes.
Not just the 20-year gap, but the contemporaneous evidence from the beginning of the 20-year gap describing the incident itself. So, again, if this was a case of leg numbness and diabetes, and appellant had had leg numbness in 1982, but did not get service-connected for diabetes in 2001, and for whatever reason did not appeal the effective date of the diabetes until 2001, there would still be a lot easier etiological opinion to be made about whether the diabetes had been there and had caused the leg numbness. But in this case, not just because the case for secondary service connection is so attenuated for proximate cause, but also, yes, the 20-year gap and the fact that appellant had not made this argument until 2005, even though he filed with the RO in 1983.
Okay. So if the facts were different, if in fact there were no barbiturates involved here and the diagnosis that occurred in 2002 for PTSD actually made it clear that based on the veteran's record beginning in 1980, these symptoms existed. Would your analysis be different?
Certainly, Your Honor. It would. The focus of our argument is on proximate cause. And so if the facts were different such that proximate cause was established, our argument would accept that. Any further questions? Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
As I believe the panel has observed, the general counsel has done an adequate job of explaining what the board did. The board simply didn't do what they were required to do under 7104. The government is relying upon a parenthetical reference to the contemporaneous records and then goes on at length to describe those contemporaneous records, which is precisely what is absent from the board's analysis. There is no analysis of those contemporaneous records. There is simply a declaration that they exist.
Counsel, look at RBA page 8. I just quoted that. In the present case, service treatment records, including service separation examination. And there's several references to...
There are references to them, Your Honor. There are not the explanation that we just heard from the government about how they relate to why service connection is not entitled on either a direct or a secondary basis. It is simply not adequate for the board to make reference to the existence of evidence, and it is required under 7104 for them to explain how that relates to, and you'll recall, Your Honor, the ultimate declaration, the ultimate conclusion by the board is that the board was unable to reasonably associate. Well, part of the reason they were unable to reasonably associate is that they violated McClendon.
Indulge me for a moment.
Yes, Your Honor.
Mr. Carpenter. Significantly, various records dating from the time of the aforementioned incident show no evidence that a psychiatric disorder played any part in the veteran's behavior at the time of his injuries. That's on page 8 of the RBA. Page 9 of the RBA goes on to say the board acknowledges the veteran's arguments regarding the origin of the disability at issue. However, it rejects those arguments. It seems to me that the board is offering an explanation.
With all due respect, Your Honor, I do not believe they are. They are simply categorically rejecting them. They are not explaining why they are rejected. There is no explanation, as has been offered today by the government, to explain that rejection, that there was no intercurrent cause, that there was no clear connection, and this is where the McClendon violation becomes critical in this case, because they did not go out and seek evidence that might have provided that. And that is where they made the quasi-Colvin violation by substituting their own judgment about what the contemporaneous evidence was that would have supported a conclusion that there was no relationship. What they are saying is that there is nothing in those contemporaneous records that expressly declared a relationship. And why would there have been in 1980 or in the early 1980s? Because at that time, there was no acknowledgement of service connection for post-traumatic stress disorder. What the board was facing in this decision was a determination that he was entitled to service-connected compensation for his post-traumatic stress disorder disability. Thereafter, in 2005, he sought secondary service connection. There was no effort to use rely upon those records as a basis to support his assertion that there was an indication that there was a relationship. And the very statement that there was nothing there is supportive of the requirement under the statute that there is no medical evidence upon which you can draw a conclusion. They essentially drew a conclusion based upon the absence of evidence. But the absence of evidence is not evidence.
No, they did make credibility determinations as well, didn't they?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. They referenced credibility. They said that it was not credible. They said the veteran's statement and history, when weighed against the objective evidence of record. But with all respect, Your Honor, there is no objective evidence of record. There is evidence of record that doesn't address the question. That is not objective evidence that declares there is no relationship. That is a conclusion drawn by the board based upon the absence of evidence in the record. The other the final point that I'd like to make in this matter is the, I believe, mischaracterization of the requirements under 3.310A that were made by the government in the government's presentation. The government suggests that in order to prevail, that Mr. Frost must have been justified in having been shot. I don't understand that in relationship to the requirements of 3.310A. There is simply a requirement that there is now additional post-service disabilities that are reasonably related to the service-connected disability under 3.310A. The government takes the position that was not explored at all by the board in its decision, that proximate cause requires something more in terms of evidence that Mr. Frost was in fact shot based upon his behavior. There's no requirement in 3.310 that says that. What 3.310A says is that his existing post-service disabilities are relatable to his existing service-connected disability. And that was never developed, that was never explored, and that was never addressed in the reasons or bases for either the denial of direct or secondary, or for the failure to obtain that necessary medical opinion. Unless there's further questions from the panel.
I just would like to say something. I think you both are very well prepared and are very articulate in your positions, but I have to note my displeasure and disappointment and frustration. I feel like both sides have made arguments that were not presented in your briefs, and that does not help the court. If you're going to change your position, I think you can seek to file a supplemental brief or something like that. But we prepare based on what is presented to us, and that helps us have a good articulate exchange. And us saying, wait, what? You're arguing this now is less productive. So I'd just like to note that.
Thank you. Counsel, are you?
I had concluded.
You all finished? Okay. Thank you. The case will be submitted for consideration. The court will now come down and greet counsel.